A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching a lot of press conferences lately, and he's curious about the people standing behind those podiums. Who are these government spokespeople, professionally speaking? What does their day actually look like? And he wants us to look beyond just the White House. What's this role like in other countries around the world? There's a lot to unpack here, because the job looks completely different depending on where you're standing.
The first thing that jumps out when you look at the data is how much the background varies by country and by administration. In the U, the current White House press secretary is Caroline Leavitt. She's 28 years old, the youngest ever to hold the role. Before this, she was the national press secretary for the Trump campaign, and before that, she worked in congressional communications. She's a comms person through and through. That's actually the norm for the U.
Which is interesting, because you'd think, or at least I'd think, that the person speaking for the president would need deep policy expertise. But that's not really what the job is.
It's not, and that's the key thing to understand. Press secretary is almost never a policy expert. They're a communications professional. You go back through the list, Karine Jean-Pierre came from Move On and the Obama White House comm shop. Jen Psaki was the State Department spokesperson before she became White House press secretary, so she had foreign policy fluency, but her core skill was messaging. Kayleigh McEnany was a political commentator and campaign spokesperson. Sarah Huckabee Sanders worked on campaigns. Sean Spicer was the RNC communications director. The pattern is remarkably consistent.
The job is essentially, you're a highly skilled translator. You take whatever the policy people are doing and convert it into something that can survive. 100 journalists trying to punch holes in it.
And the skill set is very specific. You need to know what you can say, what you absolutely cannot say, and how to navigate the enormous gray area in between. You need to understand the news cycle, which outlets matter for which audiences, and how a quote will play in the morning headlines versus the evening cable shows. The actual substance of, say, tariff policy or defense appropriations, that's what the briefings are for. You don't need to be an economist. You need to know which three sentences the economist gave you that won't blow up.
It's the public-facing edge of a much larger machine. And the weird thing is, for all the visibility, the press secretary doesn't actually make decisions. They're not in the room for most of the meetings that produce the policies they're defending.
That's partly true and partly not. The press secretary is usually in the senior staff meetings. They're not in the situation room for classified briefings, but they're in the morning comms huddle. They know what the line of the day is because they helped craft it. But you're right, they're not the decision makers. They're the people who have to stand there at 1:15 in the afternoon and say, the president's position is clear about something they learned at 11 that morning.
Let's talk about what that day actually looks like. Daniel's prompt asks about the day in the life, and I have to imagine it starts absurdly early.
It starts before dawn, and I'm not being dramatic. The typical day for a White House press secretary begins around 4:30 or 5 in the morning. They're reading the overnight news, not just U outlets, but international coverage, because whatever happened in Asia or Europe while Washington was sleeping is going to come up. They're scanning the major papers, the wire services, the cable news chyrons from the night before. By 5:30, they're usually on a call with the communications team.
This is before they've had coffee, presumably.
One hopes they've had coffee. By 6 or 6:30, they're at the White House. There's a senior staff meeting, often called the comms huddle, where they go through what's expected to drive the news that day. What's the president doing? What's on the schedule? Are there any breaking developments? What's the message the White House wants to push? And what are the vulnerabilities reporters are going to probe?
They're essentially gaming out the attack surface.
They're identifying where the questions are going to come from and preparing responses. By 8 or 9, they're deep in prep materials, briefing books that the research team has assembled. These books contain everything from policy details to anticipated questions to suggested talking points. The press secretary is studying these, making notes, sometimes doing a mock briefing with staffers playing the role of aggressive reporters.
I love the image of some 23-year-old deputy assistant press secretary absolutely shredding their boss in a practice session.
That's literally the job. You want the practice to be harder than the real thing. If you can handle your own staff trying to trip you up, you can handle Peter Doocy or Caitlin Collins. And the prep isn't just about facts, it's about tone. How do you answer a question about a tragic event without sounding robotic? How do you push back on a false premise without looking evasive? These are performance skills.
The briefing itself, that's the part everyone sees. What time does that usually happen?
Traditionally, it's been early afternoon, 1 o'clock, 1:30. Under different administrations, the timing has shifted. During the first Trump term, briefings became less frequent and sometimes were replaced by the president himself taking questions. In the current administration, briefings have returned to a more regular cadence, though they're not always daily. The briefing itself usually runs 30 to 45 minutes, sometimes longer if there's a major story breaking.
The cameras cut and everyone goes home?
Far from it. After the briefing, the press secretary often does follow-up interviews, sometimes with print reporters who need more detail, sometimes with TV correspondents for the evening news. There's usually an afternoon meeting to assess how the briefing went and what needs to be adjusted for the next day. Then there's the evening news cycle to monitor. The press secretary's phone is basically never off. I saw a profile of Jen Psaki where she said she'd get calls at 10:30 at night about something that was going to be in the next morning's papers.
It's a brutal job. And you're doing it knowing that one bad briefing can define your entire tenure in the public imagination.
Sean Spicer's first briefing, where he made false claims about inauguration crowd sizes, that became the defining image of his time in the role, fairly or not. Every press secretary knows that history. The podium is a place where credibility is both your primary asset and the thing most constantly under attack.
Let's zoom out, because Daniel specifically asked about other countries. And this is where it gets really interesting, because the U model is actually pretty unusual globally.
The daily televised briefing with adversarial questioning, that's not the norm in most democracies. In the UK, the Prime Minister's spokesperson, historically called the Prime Minister's official spokesperson, gives briefings to the lobby journalists, but they were off camera for decades. They only started being televised in recent years, and even now they're much less combative than the U. The British system relies heavily on the lobby, a group of political journalists who get background briefings on an unattributable basis.
Meaning, the spokesperson can say things without their name attached.
It's a completely different relationship with the press, less performative, more transactional. The journalists get information they can use, and the government gets to shape the narrative without a viral clip of the spokesperson sweating through a tough question.
Briefing is theater in a way that the UK version just isn't.
That's not an accident. System was designed, or evolved, really, around the idea of the press as a check on executive power. The daily briefing is a ritual of accountability, even if it sometimes becomes a ritual of evasion. Other countries have different accountability mechanisms.
What about France?
France is fascinating. The government spokesperson there is actually a minister-level position. They sit in the Council of Ministers meetings. So, unlike the U model, the French spokesperson is part of the policy conversation from the beginning. They report on the council's decisions directly after the meetings. It's a more integrated role. The current spokesperson under the Beirut government is Sophie Primas. She's also the minister delegate for government spokesperson. She has a portfolio beyond just communications.
She's actually in the room where decisions are made, not just being told about them afterward.
And that changes the nature of the job significantly. She can speak with genuine authority about what was discussed and why decisions were made, because she was there. Press secretary often has to say, "I'd refer you to the relevant agency," or "I haven't discussed that with the president." The French spokesperson doesn't have that gap in the same way.
Although I imagine there's still plenty they can't say.
Of course there are. But the starting point is different. The French model treats the spokesperson as a participant in governance, not just a messenger.
What about countries where the spokesperson role is even more tightly controlled? I'm thinking of places like Russia or China.
In those systems, the spokesperson is essentially an extension of the state propaganda apparatus. Maria Zakharova, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson, she's been in that role since 2015, and she's known for extremely combative, often sarcastic briefings that are clearly designed for domestic consumption as much as international. She's not answering questions in the sense of providing information. She's performing a narrative. The Chinese foreign ministry spokespeople, there are usually several who rotate, operate similarly. Their briefings are heavily scripted, questions are often pre-screened, and the answers are designed to reinforce official positions without revealing anything the state doesn't want revealed.
The contrast with the U model is stark. In one system, the spokesperson is trying to manage the tension between transparency and message discipline. In the other, transparency isn't really the goal at all.
Even within democracies, there's enormous variation. Look at Israel. The Israeli government spokesperson operates in an environment where the press corps is incredibly aggressive and the stakes of every statement are existential. The IDF spokesperson in particular has one of the hardest jobs in the world. They're explaining military operations in real time to a global audience that includes hostile actors parsing every word for intelligence value.
The IDF spokesperson's briefings during active conflicts are a masterclass in controlled communication under impossible conditions. Every syllable is weighed.
They're often multilingual, doing briefings in Hebrew, English, and Arabic, each with slightly different emphases because the audiences are different. That's a skill set that goes far beyond what most government spokespeople need to do.
Let me ask you something. The prompt is asking about who these people tend to be professionally. We've talked about the U pattern, campaign comms, political operatives. Is that universal?
Not at all. In many countries, the spokesperson comes from a journalism background, which creates an interesting dynamic. They've been on the other side of the podium. In Germany, the government spokesperson, currently Stefan Hebestreit, was a journalist before moving into government communications. He worked for the German press agency and various newspapers. That's a common path in European systems.
They know exactly how the reporters in the room are thinking, because they used to be one.
They often maintain relationships with the press corps that are more collegial than adversarial. The German system doesn't have the same us versus them dynamic that characterizes the White House briefing room. It's more of a professional exchange between people who understand each other's constraints.
Is one model better than the other? The journalist turned spokesperson versus the political operative.
I'm not sure better is the right framework. They produce different things. The journalist spokesperson tends to be more fluent in the language of the press. They understand lead times. They know what makes a story. They're less likely to make unforced errors about process. But they can also be too cozy with the press corps, too willing to give background access in ways that blur accountability. The political operative understands the electoral stakes and the messaging discipline required for a coherent political project. But they can be too combative, too focused on winning the daily news cycle at the expense of credibility.
The ideal is probably someone who has a foot in both worlds.
The rare ones do. Jen Psaki had State Department experience and campaign experience. She understood foreign policy and domestic politics. That's unusual.
What about the personal toll? We've described the schedule, but we haven't really talked about what it does to a person to be that visible, that scrutinized, for years.
It's well documented. The burnout rate is extremely high. Most White House press secretaries last 2 to 3 years at most. The ones who go longer, and this is true across countries, tend to develop what one profile called a certain emotional callus. You have to be able to take hits without internalizing them. You have to be able to defend a policy you privately disagree with. You have to be able to stand in front of cameras on a day when you're exhausted, or grieving, or furious, and project calm competence.
The performative emotional labor of it is staggering. You're not just conveying information, you're conveying an entire effective stance. The administration is confident. The administration is compassionate. The administration is resolute. Whatever the required emotion is, you have to embody it.
If you fail, if your face betrays doubt or frustration or exhaustion, that becomes the story, not whatever policy you were discussing.
There's something almost cruel about it. We've designed a system where the spokesperson's humanity is simultaneously required and punished. We want them to seem authentic, but any authentic moment that doesn't match the desired narrative is treated as a gaffe.
That's the fundamental tension of the role. Authenticity is demanded, but only permitted within narrow bounds. The best spokespeople find a way to be genuinely themselves while staying on message, and that's incredibly hard to do.
Let's talk about a dimension we haven't touched. Gender. The spokesperson role in many countries has become a place where women have been highly visible, sometimes in administrations that are otherwise heavily male.
The White House press secretary role has been held by women for most of the last two decades. Dana Perino, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Kayleigh McEnany, Jen Psaki, Karine Jean-Pierre, Caroline Leavitt. The only men in recent memory were Sean Spicer, Robert Gibbs, and a few others going back further. The pattern is striking.
It's not just the U. The spokesperson role in many governments skews female in a way that cabinet positions often don't.
There's been some academic work on this. One theory is that communications roles are coded as support functions rather than leadership functions, and so they're more open to women even in contexts where leadership roles remain male-dominated. Another theory is that women are perceived, fairly or not, as more credible messengers in certain contexts, particularly when the message involves empathy or de-escalation.
You get this weird dynamic where the most visible face of the government is often a woman, even when the government itself is overwhelmingly male in its decision-making ranks.
That visibility is a double-edged sword. It creates role models and pathways, but it also exposes those women to a level of scrutiny and criticism that their male counterparts often don't face. The research on this is pretty clear. Women in high-visibility political roles receive more coverage about their appearance, their tone, their likability, in ways that male spokespeople simply don't.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders faced a level of personal vitriol that I don't think any male press secretary has ever experienced. Whatever you think of her performance, the personal dimension of the attacks was unmistakable.
Karine Jean-Pierre faced a different but equally intense set of pressures. As the first black woman and first openly LGBTQ person in the role, she was carrying representational weight that no one should have to carry while also doing an impossible job.
The job is hard enough without being a symbol.
That's the thing about the spokesperson role. You're always a symbol whether you want to be or not. You're not just speaking for the government. You are, in some sense, the government made flesh. People project onto you everything they feel about the administration.
Which brings us to something Daniel hinted at in the prompt. The crisis dimension. The spokesperson's job transforms completely when something goes wrong.
Crisis communications is an entire subfield, and government spokespeople are its most visible practitioners. In a crisis, the normal rhythms go out the window. The briefing might happen multiple times a day. The spokesperson might be on camera within minutes of a breaking event. The pressure multiplies by orders of magnitude.
The stakes of getting it wrong are catastrophic. If you misstate the number of casualties in a disaster, or you claim something is under control when it isn't, or you make a promise the government can't keep, that follows you forever.
There's a famous case study from the UK. During the foot and mouth disease outbreak in 2001, the government's chief spokesperson, Alistair Campbell, who was Tony Blair's communications director, basically took over the entire government communications apparatus. Daily briefings, coordinated messaging across departments, rapid response to misinformation. It became a model for crisis communications, but it also showed how much power the spokesperson role can accumulate in an emergency.
Campbell was an unusual figure. He wasn't just a spokesperson. He was one of the most powerful people in the Blair government, period.
That's the other pattern worth noting. In some systems, the spokesperson accumulates power far beyond what the org chart would suggest. They're in every meeting. They know everything. They have the ear of the leader constantly. The formal title might be press secretary, but the actual influence is closer to chief of staff.
Because information is power, and the spokesperson sits at the nexus of all information flows. They know what the press is asking, what the agencies are saying, what the leader is thinking. Nobody else has that full picture.
In authoritarian systems, the spokesperson's power can be even more pronounced because they control the only authorized narrative. If you're the person who decides what the state says publicly, you're effectively deciding what counts as reality for the domestic audience.
That's a terrifying amount of power.
And it's why the role attracts a certain personality type. People who are comfortable with that level of responsibility, who can process enormous amounts of information quickly, and who don't crumble under constant pressure. The job selects for resilience, and sometimes for ruthlessness.
Let me ask a question that might sound naive. Why do governments still do this? In an era of social media, direct presidential communication, tweets and posts and live streams, why maintain the spokesperson ritual at all?
That's actually a great question, and people have been predicting the death of the press briefing for decades. But it persists because it serves functions that direct communication can't replace. First, it provides a regular, predictable forum for the press to ask questions. Without it, access becomes ad hoc and favors outlets with privileged relationships. Second, it creates a public record. The briefing transcript is an official document that can be cited and scrutinized. Third, it allows the government to test messages and see how they land, in a setting that's high stakes but not uncontrolled.
It's a pressure release valve as much as anything. Better to let the press corps yell at the spokesperson for 45 minutes than to have them digging through back channels for information.
The briefing is a ritual of managed conflict. It channels adversarial energy into a bounded space and a bounded time. And for all the complaints about how briefings have become less substantive, more performative, they still matter. The questions that get asked shape coverage. The answers that get given constrain what the administration can say later. The whole thing is a dance, but it's a dance with real consequences.
What about countries that don't do this? That don't have a regular televised briefing?
They tend to be less transparent, almost by definition. If there's no regular forum where the press can ask questions on camera, the government has more control over what information gets out and how it's framed. Some countries use written statements exclusively. Others do occasional press conferences with the leader directly, bypassing the spokesperson entirely. The Japanese system, for instance. The chief cabinet secretary holds briefings twice a day, but they're often heavily scripted and the questions are sometimes submitted in advance.
Submitting questions in advance defeats the entire purpose of a press conference, doesn't it?
Depends what you think the purpose is. If the purpose is accountability, yes. If the purpose is information dissemination, no. Different systems have different theories of what they're doing.
I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier, the career trajectory. What happens after you've been the face of a government for 2 or 3 years? Where do these people go?
It varies enormously. Some go into the private sector, corporate communications, crisis consulting, public affairs. The skills are directly transferable and the pay is dramatically better. Others go into media, becoming commentators or hosts. Jen Psaki went to MSNBC. Kayleigh McEnany went to Fox News. Some stay in politics, moving into senior advisory roles or running communications for campaigns. A few write books. The ones who are particularly well-regarded sometimes get tapped for even more senior government roles.
The podium is a launching pad, not a destination.
For most, yes. The exceptions are the career civil servants who become spokespeople for government agencies, the State Department spokesperson, the Pentagon spokesperson. Those roles are often filled by foreign service officers or career officials who've been doing communications work for years and will continue doing it after their time at the podium ends. They're not political appointees, and their career arc looks different.
The State Department spokesperson is an interesting case because they're briefing on foreign policy, which requires actual subject matter expertise in a way that domestic political messaging might not.
The current State Department spokesperson, and this has been true across administrations, typically has deep regional expertise, often speaks multiple languages, and has served in embassies abroad. They're not just reading talking points. They understand the substance, and reporters know if they don't.
Which brings us back to the question of what makes someone good at this job. We've talked about resilience, messaging discipline, performance skills. But there's also a dimension of intellectual honesty that matters, maybe more than anything else.
The best spokespeople in any system are the ones who maintain credibility. Once you've lost that, you can't get it back. And credibility doesn't mean always telling the full truth. No spokesperson does that because no government does that. It means not being caught in a lie. It means being careful with language in ways that allow you to be technically truthful even when you're not being fully transparent.
That's a pretty fine ethical line to walk.
And different people handle it differently. Some are comfortable with aggressive spin. Others try to be as straightforward as the constraints allow. The ones who last longest tend to be the ones who find a way to live with themselves while doing a job that inherently involves managing, shaping, and sometimes withholding the truth.
The moral psychology of the spokesperson is probably worth a whole episode on its own.
It absolutely is. There's a reason many of them describe the job as the hardest thing they've ever done, professionally and personally. You're in the spotlight, you're making split-second judgments with enormous consequences, and you're doing it all while knowing that a significant portion of the public will never trust anything you say.
Because you're speaking for an institution, and institutions have agendas.
The spokesperson's job is to advance that agenda while maintaining enough credibility to be useful to the press. It's an impossible balancing act, and the fact that anyone does it well is remarkable.
Let's talk about one more dimension before we start to wrap up. The relationship between the spokesperson and the principal. The president, the prime minister, the foreign minister. That relationship determines everything about how the spokesperson operates.
It's the single most important variable. Some leaders want a spokesperson who's essentially a human shield, someone who takes the hits so the principal doesn't have to. Others want a strategic partner who helps shape the message from the beginning. Some leaders micromanage every word the spokesperson says. Others are barely aware of what's being said in their name.
The nightmare scenario for a spokesperson is a principal who goes off script in ways that contradict what the spokesperson just said from the podium.
That happens more often than you'd think. The spokesperson does a carefully calibrated briefing, threading a needle on some sensitive issue, and then the leader tweets something that blows the whole thing up. And the spokesperson has to go back out the next day and explain how those two things are actually consistent.
The job of squaring the unsquareable.
Some of the most memorable briefing room moments come from exactly that dynamic. The spokesperson is asked about something the president said, and you can see them trying to construct a coherent interpretation of something that was never intended to be coherent.
It's almost a form of literary criticism at that point. Exegesis of the leader's utterances.
There's an academic paper in that somewhere. The spokesperson is textual interpreter of an unstable original text.
I'd read it. All right, let's pull this together. Daniel asked who these people are, what their days look like, and how the role varies globally. I think we've covered a lot of ground. The short version, they're communications professionals, occasionally journalists, almost never policy experts. The days start before dawn and never really end. And the role looks radically different depending on whether you're in Washington, Paris, Moscow, or Tokyo.
The common thread is that they all live at the intersection of information and power. They're the human interface between the government and the public, and that position is inherently precarious. Everyone wants something from them. Nobody fully trusts them, and they have to show up every day and do it anyway.
It's the kind of job that produces either profound wisdom or profound cynicism, and sometimes both in the same person.
I think that's exactly right. The ones who do it well develop a kind of double vision. They see the machinery of government from the inside, understand how the sausage is made, and still find a way to communicate with people who don't.
There's something almost noble about it when it's done right.
And something deeply corrosive when it's done wrong.
Now, Wilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, European cartographers attributed several detailed maps of the Nile headwaters to Ptolemy, but later scholarship revealed the source was actually Al-Idrisi's 12th century work, which itself drew on traders who had reached as far south as what is now South Sudan, making those maps the most accurate depiction of the Upper Nile until the 19th century.
The Nile had a better press agent than we thought.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this show running. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.